like to welcome everybody to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today is January 27th, and we are calling this meeting to order at 1:32 p.m. Today we have present with us Vice Chairman Senator Mike Schauer, who was on this committee last year as well, so we've got experience. Senator Hughes, Shelley Hughes to my right, she chaired this committee last year, so we've got great experience. In addition to Senator Jesse Keel, who was also on the committee the last couple of years. And then we welcome new member, Senator Rob Meyer. So thank you very much. Of course, Chairwoman Reinbold, I'm here to remind committees, first of all, if everybody could silence their cell phones just so there's not interruptions in the committee, that would be great. I want to really thank Nancy Hemingway. She's been here a long time, and you really help us run good meetings, so we really appreciate you. Also behind us is Alex Beebe from the LIO. Really appreciate you helping us get people online and making sure that our equipment is working. Tim Banaszak, is he here? Thank you. We've got new technology today, so we actually are able to see people on the screen, video teleconferencing, so we're really thankful to the Senate President for authorizing it, and Tim, you being with us last night and early this morning, really appreciate that. And I really want to say thank you to Kelly Toth. She's worked extremely long hours to help prepare this. We've only got our assignments a week ago, and so this was a tremendous undertaking by my staff, Kelly Toth. And it's our first committee aide as an official committee aide, so please show us some grace and patience today. So in regards to the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm going to go over some ground rules. This is the Senate Judiciary Committee according to uniform rules, and it is found on page 8. And the legislative, executive, and judicial branches have checks and balances, as we all know. And in regards to the Judiciary Committee and the legislature, it's found under Rule 20. And we oversee programs and activities in regards to the Alaska court system, the Department of Law, legal and substantive review of bills referred to our committee for this purpose. Even above the uniform rules, we all know that the United States Constitution and the Alaska Constitution are above those. So in Article 12, Section 5, all public officials take an oath to office. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Alaska, and I will faithfully discharge my duties to the best of my ability. All of us has taken that oath, and we really want to make sure we're going to have some of the, eventually some of the Constitution up on the wall, like we did over in the House. But it's super important to recognize that that is the supreme law of the land. With the ongoing disaster declarations, they have posed serious legal concerns, and the 18 mandates and the health and 8 of the health orders that are still in place right now have raised constitutional concerns. These have been approved by the Department of Law, and so Judiciary is the appropriate committee to review this. I want to remind people online that are watching today and committee members, I'm sure you all are aware of this, but in Article 1 of the State Constitution is the inherent rights. The Constitution is dedicated to the principles that all persons have a natural right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the enjoyment of the rewards of their own industry, and that all persons are equal and entitled to equal rights, opportunity, and protection under the law, and that all persons have corresponding obligations to the people and to the state. Article 1, Section 2, the source of government. All you people listening online, all political power is inherent in the people. All government originates with the people and is founded on their will alone as an instituted for the good of the people as a whole. Section 3 goes over civil rights. No person is denied the enjoyment of any civil political right because of race, color, creed, sex, or national origin, and the legislature is responsible for implementing this section. Section 4 is the freedom of religion. No law shall be made respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the exercise thereof, including mandates. Freedom of speech, every person may freely speak, write, and publish on all subjects, being responsible for the abuse of that right. Section 6, the assembly. Petition, the right of the people to petition to assemble their government and petition the government shall never be abridged. Section 7, due process. No person shall be deprived of the right of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The right of all persons to a fair and just treatment in the course of legislative and executive investigations shall not be infringed. Section 9, jeopardy and self-incrimination. No person shall be put in jeopardy twice for the same offense, and no person shall be compelled in any criminal proceeding to be witness against himself. And I'm only going to do two more right now. Searches and seizures, and these are things that are being impacted by the mandates, and that is why we are highlighting these. Section 14, searches and seizures. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and other property shall not be violated. No warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause supported by the oath or affirmation and particularly described in the place to be searched or the persons or things to be seized. And finally, one of my favorite parts of the Constitution, the right to privacy. The right of the people to privacy is recognized and shall not be infringed. The legislature shall implement this section. As you all know, the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Alaska are freely and readily available, and I'd encourage everybody to keep them close and know your rights. So we requested several members to be here today, and the administration has not approved those at this time. So we are going to deal with the people that were approved by the administration to be here. And we're going to focus in particular on lockdowns for school closures, elderly, and our most vulnerable populations. Want you to know that the mandates will all be, all 18 of the governor's mandates will be posted under the documents for today's meeting. And we apologize. We've tried about a half a dozen times to upload those documents, and there's been some technical aspects. And I know Tim Banaszak in your department is working on those technical issues. Today we have two presentations on the agenda, and we want to welcome Sarah Vance. Is there any other legislators in the audience? Thank you, Representative Vance. Okay, I know there's probably several online, but we want to welcome them. But in regards to the agenda today, first of all, in every member got packets, and we provided today's agenda, the people petition to their government that we worked on and also was part of the legislature, was given to all the members of the legislature last session, some issues with the mandates and the constitutional concerns that we raised. The Great Barrington Declaration is in your packets. Commissioner Crum has a presentation in the packets from the Department of Health and Social Services. Want the people to know we are going to allow the presenters to go ahead and have their presentations, and we'll have a short question and answer session at the end of those. I want to let everybody know online we have Stacy Crawley, Assistant Attorney General from Department of Law. We have Dr. Joe McLaughlin, the State Epidemiologist, Division of Public Health. We have Paloma Harbor, Policy Analyst for Office of Management and Budget. And Brian Fisher, Emergency Program Manager from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. We asked them, you know, to delay, but I think they're just going to hang on today just for observation, because this is going to set a lot of precedent for what we talk about in the future. And now we get to an honorable speaker. Today with us we have Dr. Kuhldorf, and everybody, you can see him online there, so this is super exciting. Thank you that the technology is working. And he is a professor of medicine at Harvard University. He's a biostatistician and epidemiologist with expertise in detecting and monitoring infectious disease outbreaks and vaccine safety evaluations, and co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration. Dr. Kuhldorf will review the Great Barrington Declaration and provide some background surrounding what it is and why it was written with his colleagues, and also just want to point out that the Declaration has been interpreted in 43 different languages, and over 727,000 concerned citizens have read this. 13,290 medical and public health scientists, and over 40,000. It's been interpreted by over 40,000 practitioners. And please help me welcome Dr. Kuhldorf, and if you could just state your name and any type of introduction you would want, and you've got the floor. Just a second. One second. It's not on here.
Make sure he's not on.
Just let him know he's muted.
Just a second. You're muted, doctor. Or hold on.
Do you hear me now?
Okay, you go ahead and state your name. We cannot hear you yet. Make sure you're unmuted on your side. Kelly Toth, it shows you're, are you muted?
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Perfect.
Perfect. So my name is Martin Kuldorff. I'm a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. I'm a biostatistician and an epidemiologist, and I worked on infectious disease outbreaks for a couple of decades. That has been my main area of research. With the pandemic, when the pandemic started, it was very stunning to both me and many of my infectious disease epidemiology colleagues what the approach was taken. And the key feature of COVID-19 is that while anybody can get infected, and people get infected from all ages, the risk of mortality, as well as hospitalization, but if you look at mortality, is more than thousandfold difference between the oldest and the youngest. So among old people, COVID-19 is more serious than the annual influenza. For children, on the other hand, COVID-19 is much less dangerous than the annual influenza. And this is something that we should have used and we should use as much as possible to control and deal with this pandemic. It should be clear by now that the idea of doing general lockdowns of the whole population has not worked. It has not worked to control this pandemic. It has sometimes pushed the problem forward in time a little bit, but it has not worked to control it. And I think that is obvious by now. The problem is that by thinking that it would work to protect the older high-risk people by doing a general lockdown of the whole population, there were not put in place measures, focused protection measures for those older people as it should have been. So when we wrote the Great Barrington Declaration, there were two parts of that. One is an urging to do a much better job protecting the high-risk older people, which we were not doing as good a job as could have been done and could be done, and which is sort of using the very basic principles of public health that's been around for decades. The other aspect of it is that by closing schools and having fewer hospital medical appointments and doing lockdowns, etc., that has had enormous negative collateral damage on public health, on other aspects of public health. And one of the fundamental principles of public health is that you don't only consider one disease, you have to consider health as a whole. So, for example, childhood immunization rates have plummeted because of the lockdowns. People are not screened for cancer, getting the treatment for cancer that they should. So we have less cancer in 2020 than previous year, but that's not because there are less cancers. It's not because they're not detected, and therefore they're not treated. Cardiovascular disease outcomes are worse, and of course the mental health consequences are enormous. So we have all this collateral damage on because of the lockdowns that needs to be part of the equation. So what the Great Barrington Declaration say is we have to do a better job protecting older high-risk people at the same time as we have to let young people, children and young adults, to live near normal lives. They should still wash their hands and stay home when sick and so on, but the damage from, for example, closing schools is enormous, while there is no public health benefit in terms of COVID of closing schools, and I will come to that a little bit later. So this is why in early October, three of us, myself, Professor of Medicine Jay Bhattacharya at Stanford University, and Professor of Ethnology at Oxford University, Dr. Sunetra Gupta. We have all worked many, many years on infectious disease ethnology, and we put forward this focus protection, as we call it, as an alternative to the lockdowns. And this wasn't anything novel that the three of us came up with. Many people have been advocating this already since March. But even more so, if we go back to the pandemic preparedness plans that had been put in place by most countries in previous years in preparation for a pandemic, it follows those basic principles. So this focus protection is nothing new or novel from a public health perspective. It is it's lockdowns that is something that has never been tried before. And that's a huge experiment. And I would say by now it should be clear that these lockdowns is the biggest public health fiasco ever. So that's sort of a summary of the Great Barrington Declaration. One thing I'd like to go into a little bit more is protection of elderly and the children. If we start with the old people, of course, now when we have a vaccine, which is fantastic, we need to prioritize vaccinating old people, especially in the nursing homes, and I think Alaska is doing that. But we need to prioritize vaccination by age because those are the highest risk. But there are also other things that we still have to do. We have to do more testing at nursing homes, both of staff and visitors, more frequent testing, less staff rotation at nursing homes. People are in their 60s, they are also at somewhat higher risk, so we should help them so that they could take a sabbatical now when the virus is transmitting very much. So we should have some kind of help for them to be protecting themselves. And what we essentially have done now is we have protected the affluent professionals who can work from home. Some people call them the laptop class, who at the same time as the working class is the one who has taken the burden of this pandemic, both in terms of being infected and therefore generating immunity in the population that eventually protects everybody, but also the consequences on public health has been the severest on the working class, on children and old people and the poor. So this has sort of been a double whammy for those less affluent in society, while the affluent professional class, people like me, lawyers, journalists, scientists, have been to a large extent protected by these lockdowns. Another thing that is important is children. So as I said, the risk of mortality or the risk from this disease for children is less than the annual influenza. Every year in the United States, depending on the flu season, there will be between 200 and 1,000 children dying from influenza each year. And in the U.S. for 2020, less than that has died, less than 200 has died from COVID. And you might say that, well, that's maybe because we closed the schools and that saved them. But if you want to look at it then scientifically, we have to look at the one place where schools were kept open throughout the height of the pandemic in the spring, and that was Sweden. So Sweden had a lot of transmission of the virus in the spring, but it kept daycares and schools open from ages 1 to 15. So they all, 1.8 million children, they all went to school during this whole springtime. And among these 1.8 million children, exactly zero died from COVID-19. There were a few hospitalizations, but not very many. So that shows that even when schools are open, this is not a dangerous disease for children. So the children are taking a huge burden, and not just lack of education, which is, of course, very serious, but also it affects their physical health and their mental health and their social development. So I think that's an enormously tragic part of this pandemic, that we have deprived children from going to in-person schools without there being any public health reasons to do so. Then the question is with schools, is also we also have the concern about teachers. So if you again look at Sweden, it turns out that obviously teachers are older, so they have higher risk than children. But comparing the teachers and children who were seeing students all the time, every day, they were at less risk of COVID-19 than the average of other professions in Sweden. So they're actually at the lower edge end of risk. And if schools were a major transmitter of this virus, they would be at higher risk rather than lower risk than others. So also for teachers, it is safe to keep the school open, with one exception, I would say. First of all, the teachers are not at risk from students, but they could be affected by other teachers. So it's good if teachers don't maybe intermingle too much. But also, teachers in their 60s, they are not at super high risk, but they have an elevated risk. So I think there is a valid concern from older teachers about their safety in any workplace, including schools. But it doesn't make sense to deprive students, children, from education just because of that. So a much better solution is to say that teachers above 60, let them work from home. Maybe they can help other teachers with grading exams or homeworks, or maybe they can do online teaching with students who are sick at home or other things. So I think there are imaginative ways to protect the older teachers who do need to protections. But for younger teachers, there's absolutely no reason not to provide in-person teaching for the students. That's sort of a summary of the philosophy behind the Great Barrington Declaration. And of course, I talked about schools and older people, but it's much broader than that. And you can read the Great Barrington Declaration itself, which, as was said, has received core signatures of more than 10,000 public health and medical scientists, over 40,000 public medical practitioners, and over 700,000 people in total. So this is not a fringe view. And while you haven't always heard about it in the media, among my personal colleagues, when I talk in private, other infectious disease epidemiologists, the majority of those I know personally support this type of focused protection approach rather than a blunt general lockdown that has caused so much damage, so much collateral damage without preventing disease. So thank you very much. That's the summary.
Thank you, Doctor. We're going to take a few questions. If you can hold on here, we'll start with Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three, and you can meter them as you see fit, Madam Chair. The first, Professor, I appreciated your presentation. You said at the beginning and alluded again at the end, lockdowns have not worked to control this pandemic. And I want to make sure I'm understanding exactly what you mean by that. Should I understand that the epidemic curve has not flattened due to the lockdowns and restrictions in place, that we are seeing the same spread of the virus that we would have seen without them?
Yes and no. So the lockdowns can flatten the curve, which means that you reduce the peak. For example, in the spring, you can reduce the peak number of hospitalizations per week. And there is a rationale to that because you don't want to overburden the hospitals. But that doesn't prevent people from getting infected. It just postpones it into the future. So it postponed it in the spring, but then since this is a seasonal disease, it also postponed it into the fall. So with an infection pandemic like this, to think that one can somehow magically suppress it is unrealistic from a public health point of view. So the key then is to properly protect those who are at higher risk of mortality, which is the older ones. And we failed to do that because people thought that lockdowns will protect everybody, and that hasn't been the case. We have had enormous mortality in COVID. I think it's 400,000 now in the U.S., and the vast majority of that are, of course, the older people. So it's very clear that these lockdowns has not managed to protect older people. A lot of nursing homes have been infected because there wasn't done enough testing, too much staff rotation, etc. And it's the same with other groups of older people. I still see older people who are in the supermarket, and we should help them that they don't have to go to the supermarket, so that they can have their groceries delivered to them. They are taking a risk by going to the supermarket, which they shouldn't do. Now, a 30-year-old, there's no problem going to the supermarket because they have very, very low risk. But somebody who's 75 should try to avoid that.
We'll let you have one more, and then there's like three more people. So, and then we'll try to circle back around if there's time, okay?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So, it's not every day I have access to a biostatistician. And so a question as to I thought your insightful suggestion that we look at all harms. Can you compare for us the list of harms from lockdowns that you mentioned, mental health crises, suicide attempts, you mentioned worse cardiac outcomes, delayed cancer screening. Can you compare the all harms damage from lockdowns that you see to the all harms damage from COVID? So the mortality number is terrible, but the morbidity and the long-term sequelae, of course, are also, I think, pretty significant. And I have anecdotes from my own life, people I know. I've got a neighbor who makes my colleague to the right here look like the 98-pound weakling from the Charles Atlas ads, who spent 4 months having to take a break between the bed and the bathroom. Those long-term cardiac outcomes are pretty significant for him. Can you compare the all harms damage of the two for us?
So we have some data on that, but it's not complete yet. So this is the full extent of the collateral damage is something that we will not know for sure until several years from now, because while COVID is very immediate, some of the collateral damage, like cardiovascular, is also immediate. But, for example, cancer is not. It's something that we're going to have to live with and die with for many years to come. So somebody, for example, who missed their cervical cancer screening, she might not die 4 years from now instead of living another 15, 20 years. So some of that data exists and others do not. One interesting statistic is if you look at so most people who die in COVID is older people. But if you look at the 25 to 44-year-old age group, we can see that about 4% of all deaths, this was a few months ago, before the end of the year, but about 4% of all deaths in 2020 until about October, November was due to COVID-19. At the same time, there was about a 25% excess deaths in this age group compared to previous years. So we don't yet know exactly how much of those is cardiovascular, how much is opiate overdoses, how much is other aspects. But we do know that the majority of the excess deaths that we have seen in this age group in 2020, where only a small proportion was due to COVID-19, and the vast majority was due to other things affected by either the lockdowns or the fear that people had of seeking medical care because they were afraid to go to the doctor. So that's one example in one age group where we can see the data. But the true extent of the collateral damage on public health is not going to be clear, tallied until much later.
Okay, we've got several more questions. So we're going to go to Senator Hughes next.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for taking out time from your busy schedule to be with us. As the Judiciary Committee and as legislators, we're the policymakers. And so one of the things we're looking at, and this is laying the foundation, understanding the impacts of the various executive orders on our population, and then what we as policy makers might need to do in order to proceed. So one of the things I did when I heard that you were speaking, I was trying to figure out what a Great Barrington Declaration, what that was about, and I could see that that's a location. It's named after the location in Massachusetts where it was signed in October of this past year. But when I Googled you and Great Barrington, one of the things that came up were a number of articles in the media regarding some of the signers being fake signers. And so can you speak to that? Because that is something that people watching this hearing might do. And I think in some of the documents that the chair provided, it looked like there were some fake signers, but perhaps you have an explanation of what occurred and that there were actually legitimate signers as well. So could you speak to that, please?
Yeah, so there were some pranksters who signed under fake names. For example, one was Johnny Bananas, etc. That's less than 1% of all the signatures, and we sort of removed those as much as possible from the count. There was also a journalist, and I'm a simple scientist, so I don't really understand the media as well as I'm sure you do as politicians, but there was one scientist who was bragging that he was adding fake names to the thing, and then other media outlets were sort of writing that fake name had been, there were fake names on the declaration. So when we see those, we remove them, and they were less than 1%.
As follow-up, Madam Chair, just as thank you, I want to read a couple of the other fake names. So we had a Professor SpongeBob SquarePants. We had a Professor Ware, W-A-R-E. The Mask, T-H-A-M-A-S-K, and Dr. Person fake name. So I just thought to squelch anyone that Googles that to realize that there were some fake names, but there were quite a few legitimate names as well. Thank you.
Yes, and I'm going to...
Yes, it's kind of humorous, and we have an FAQ for the Great Barrington Declaration, and we listed some of the more humorous names on that FAQ, just sort of as entertainment, I guess.
Correct, and I'm going to point out a correction that I, at the very beginning, my script left off that people had signed when it said the declaration interpreted in 43 languages and over 727, 145 concerned citizens signed, 13,290 medical and public scientists, and over 40,000 practitioners. So the vast majority, 99% roughly, high-level physicians, and that will all be posted up on BASIS. Okay, with that, I want to go to Vice Chairman Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Doc. I read your report months ago after it came out, just trying to get a broad brush across the Internet universe for all the different things we're seeing, because I think, as probably everybody acknowledges today, as the old joke went, well, I read it on the Internet, it must be true, right? And there is so much information, it is very difficult to parse the chaff from the wheat. So what I'm going to focus on in this question, and I understand it's more of an opinion from you as a scientist, I'm asking it for a specific reason, though. And that is, when you discuss why the decisions were made to do certain things like lockdowns and others, it does drive the policy that the policymakers, either as legislators, governors, et cetera, will enact. And that can have a huge impact. And I'll give a for example. We talk about the number of deaths, 2 million plus, and that is terrible, obviously. But on the other side, you have the United Nations saying 130 million people are going to starve to death around the planet because of the lockdowns. So which is worse, picking that? So we have to balance this, because there is a balance of trying to do this as best we can for everybody, but some things have been out of balance. And last year, we were told early on that by the middle of April, we might have 20,000 Alaskans dead based on the model. And I was myself kind of go, okay, hit the panic button. That's an issue. That's a lot of people. Well, I think we had about 9. So we were off by just under 20,000 in the count. My point of asking this question, Doc, is that to try to get it right, and to balance all sides of the equation so we don't go too far in any direction that hurts anybody more than we need to get this done, and to get through this as best we can. That why question for you is, why do you think these policies were enacted in the way they were? Was it driven by fear? Was it driven by bad science? Or as the science has gotten better and we've learned more, what drove those policy decisions so that, from your opinion, as a more as a scientist and statistician, we as policymakers can look at it and go, what's the best balance? What do we need to be aware of? Not fear, not, you know, extreme positions, but this balance we can strike so that we are, like I said, trying to hurt the least people. Because we have decisions to make, and people are being hurt by this. I mean, there's no way around it. Both those that die of the virus and those that are dying of the other collateral damage, as you call it. It's a long question. It's a little bit of an opinion, but I was curious what you might think about that. Thank you.
It's a very good question. And as a public health scientist, I was absolutely stunned back in March that these lockdowns were going into place. To flatten the curve makes sense. But to try to suppress a pandemic like this is just completely unrealistic, and it absolutely stunned me that that was the approach that the world was taking, both because it doesn't make sense from a public health perspective. Also, it threw out of the window all the principles of public health that we've been using for many decades. One is, don't look at only one disease, look at all aspects of health. So you can't just focus on COVID. Also, you can't just look short term. You have to look at the long term. You have to not to look at the public health of everybody in the population, including the poor and including the people in the developing world that was mentioned, of 130,000 potential deaths. And it's been extremely tragic in many countries in Asia and Africa and Latin America, for example. So I'm completely stunned what happened. And I guess as probably as politician, you might have a better understanding of how society operates about these things. So I don't really know why it went like this. I know that those of us in public health who try to voice our views of an alternative use than lockdowns, it was very difficult to do so. So I tried to publish in March and April in the United States my thoughts on this, and no media wanted to take the pieces. It was too they were not willing to do that. I'm a native of Sweden. So I did publish in the major newspapers in Sweden, but in the U.S. I was unable to do so until the late summer, early fall, when I was able to publish in Wall Street Journals and other places, for example. But I don't really know the answer to your question. To me, it's just stunning.
That's okay. It's a great try, and that's why I swung at the fence there, because that's a tough one. I have one follow-up, Madam Chair, very quick, and Doc, it can be yes or no. Do you believe, based on where we sit today, over a year into this pandemic, that based on the data you have seen, that we should be thinking about adjusting our policies to end lockdowns and other things to move us into a different era from the things you described? You don't have to have a long answer. I'm just looking to see whether or not we should be looking at adjusting policies now.
Yes.
Thank you.
And thank you very much. I'm just going to wrap up a few things here in regards to I'm kind of any questions right now, sorry.
Yes, no.
Okay, she's going to ask one yes, no, but I really only wanted two questions per person. So, Senator Hughes, if you can be very quick, and then I have to give him a very, very quick yes and no, but we are getting off schedule now. So, Senator Hughes, if you could quickly.
And this is my second question, just Madam Chair. Okay. So, quick yes, no. I noticed when I researched your resume that one of your specialty is in real-time post-market drug and vaccine safety surveillance. I was wondering if in the future, if you are monitoring what's happening right now with the vaccine distribution and how that impacts that, if you'll be reporting that in the future, yes or no. Thank you.
I serve on the CDC working group for COVID-19 safety monitoring. And that committee reports things through CDC.
Okay. Senator Keel, can you ask a quick question? Hopefully yes or no?
As quick as I can, Madam Chair. I can't quite get to yes, no. Professor, the issue of focused protection is one that we've certainly tried to protect folks in our pioneers' homes, in the elderly care homes around Alaska. It hasn't been successful here or in most places I've seen. In a situation where community spread is significantly increased, where should we look to a model of focused protection that would work with vastly more virus circulating to actually effectively protect the folks you recommend for focused protection? Who's done it right?
Good question. So now we have the vaccine, vaccinating both nursing home residents as well as nursing home staff, all of them, is very important. It's also important to do, until that's accomplished, it's important to do daily testing of staff as well as testing of any visitors. And it's important for the old people to have visitors from families and friends, but they need to be tested through an antigen test, which can be done the same morning. Also, it's critical to minimize staff rotation so that the same nursing home staff do not work in multiple nursing homes or even in different sections of the same nursing homes. So those are the traditional standard public health measures to do to protect them, which has been done in some places, but in other places they have not been done at all, even close to what could have been done and should have been done.
Thank you. So with that, we're going to have to move on to the next speaker, but I would like to just go ahead and, before I say thank you, say I really appreciate the work. We all appreciate the work in coming forth and having the opportunity to have you on short notice before our committee. But thank you for exposing the grave concerns about the damaging physical and mental health impact of the prevailing COVID policies. And thank you for your focused approach. We think it's so important that you have exposed that the current lockdowns, we have one in Anchorage right now that's just slowly starting to open up, but the current lockdown policies are producing devastating impacts on short and long-term public health. And thank you for the holistic. You got to look at the whole. Some of the public health crises are developing in other areas because of the super narrow focus of COVID. And I loved this in the Barrington Declaration. As immunity builds in the population, the risk of infection to all, including the vulnerable, falls. Thank you for pointing that out. Thank you for your goal. What you said, your goal is to therefore minimize mortality and social harm until we reach herd immunity. Then you said the most compassionate approach balances the risks and benefits as we reach herd immunity, and this allows those with minimal risk of death to live their lives normally and to build immunity on the virus through the natural infection while better protecting those who are at higher risk. And I know there's more to it. These are all going to be online for anybody to get on the basis. But with that, we've asked you or one of your colleagues that helped author this to be with us in future committees, and we will be in contact with you. And with that, it was an honor to have you with us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All my honor.
Okay, so we will have more opportunity for questions. You guys, they will be back, okay? So thank you guys for your energetic and enthusiastic approach to this. In regards to that, we're going to go ahead and transition now to the people who have been implementing. There's been three key people, Governor Dunleavy, Commissioner of Health and Social Services, Adam Crum, and then Dr. Zink. We did ask Dr. Zink. She was out of state right now. We're hoping to get her in the future because I've got lots of questions for her. But before we bring the commissioner up, I have actually 10 binders I've been working on the last 10 months. And so my office has been following this, and I want to recognize Jake. Thank you, Jake Almeida. He was with Kelly Toth, and I worked really hard all summer to get all this stuff in place. Want to recognize Roger Holland. Thank you so much for being here today, Senator. I want to go ahead and just highlight, this is only for educational purposes. If you want to look at the mandates yourself, you guys have to go and research like we have. We will be posting them all on basis, but just for educational purposes, I'm going to highlight some of the mandates. And today I don't have time to get into the current health orders that are in place right now, but just as a very high level mandate, 1.1, limited visitations to the elderly. Mandate 1.2, student contact was closed, schools were closed. Mandate for 2 weeks. Mandate 2.2, closed residential schools, sent them home. Mandate 3, restaurants were closed to dine in and limited to 5 people. Gyms were closed, entertainment was closed. They were arbitrarily applied. There was some exemptions in there. Mandate 4 started the travel delays. And people were told if they started getting involved in people's work and if they had traveled outside of the state, you know, to any specific areas, they needed to not go to school or work for 14 days. Mandate 5 postponed elective procedures for roughly 3 months. This is when they started directing the health care of people. This administration did. Mandate 6 postponed oral procedures starting at a month. And Mandate 7, businesses in Ketchikan and North Star Borough had to be 6 feet apart, stop all our operations, including businesses, churches, and gatherings were limited to 10 people, which, of course, impacted the constitutional rights. Mandate 8, which was issued on March 20th, this is where public and private schools were closed and all after-school activities were closed. This became a blueprint for some of the smaller committees to adopt some of these policies with the help of Governor Dunleavy, who offered Attorney General to help draft regulations for boroughs and local communities who felt they did not have jurisdiction over this area. Mandate 9 expanded Mandate 8 across the state, so all individuals had to stop working, traveling, basically, with some exclusions. Mandate 9 helped to shut down our economy, there was gathering of no more than 10 people. It impacted a lot of different things. Mandate 9 was of deep concern. Mandate 10, this is where it was arbitrarily applied. The governor decided and commissioner decided who was essential, who was not essential. This is arbitrary application of law. Mandate 5 included penalties for organizations and businesses of up to $1,000 per violation and a Class A misdemeanor. That's why law is definitely the right jurisdiction here, because we deal with criminal law in here. On page 5, persons, they were fined, I believe it was a business, was fined $25,000 and up to a $2.5 million fine if it resulted in death, and $500,000 in a Class A misdemeanor that didn't result in a death. So this really started getting tight. And none of these were approved by the legislature. I want you to know the lawmaking branch, which is the legislature, did not write any of these mandates. This is 100% on the executive branch. This is when PCR tests started entering into, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about that at some point too. Mandate 11-12 dealt with social distancing, interstate travel. There was a series of very concerning question and answers where it appeared that the department or Dr. Zink asked the question and answered the question. And people were mandated to stay in their place of residency. This was basically hunker down. You know, there was a hunker down order. A couple questions that were with the HESS, Health and Social Services, and the Dr. Zink was, can I visit my loved one in the hospital? The answer was no. Another one was, it allowed marijuana shops to potentially stay open, so that was definitely part of the state mandates. People need to understand that the blueprint was put in place by the state. Another question was, can I visit my significant other if I don't live in the same household? They said no. Mandate 12, I believe it started on March 28th, this started impacting state between communities, and it was prohibited except for critical infrastructure. What was concerning to me on this mandate was stamped on it, that this mandate supersedes any local government or tribal mandate or directive or order restricting interstate travel. Mandate 13 closed K-12 public and private schools through the end of 2019-20 and prohibited graduation events, basically. Mandate 14, a non-congregate shelter, and this allowed them to quarantine people in non-traditional places, first responders, homeless, et cetera, and they were allowed to use hotels, dormitories, et cetera. Mandate 15 discussed healthcare service, including universal masking, and is essentially getting into the detail of micro-bandaging the healthcare facilities. Mandate 16 probably raised the biggest alarm for me personally. It basically was the Reopen Alaska plan, and it went in effect roughly on April 24th. It had attachments D, E, F, G, H, I, all the way to T. That is a key mandate that was the blueprint for pretty much managing businesses across the state, private sector businesses. And 16, basically on page 3 is Q, letter Q. There's a 3-page detailed rules of how bars could open, and they could not open without every single one of those rules. So they were actually laws, requirements, you know, it was a blueprint for bars. And so people just didn't, they weren't paying as much attention back then. In regards to Mandate 17, it got in great detail about independent commercial fishing vessels. Mandate 18 went into effect May 12th, and it limited more interstate travel restrictions. There were also several health alerts. There was 11 health alerts issued, and I want to point to everyone to please read Health Alert 11. It basically told how far cars should be parked apart during a church service, and the health alert also talked about how to put together an Easter basket. I thought that was very micromanaging, and that where face cloth coverings had to be worn, et cetera. In particular to note, I want to note that on March 11th, when the disaster declaration was first declared, there was zero cases in the state of Alaska, and then these things just came out like this. These mandates and health alerts just came over without input from the legislature. I want you guys to know that, which to me is this very severe separation of powers issues. And that's why, again, this is the right committee to deal with this. I will be having a bill in regards to separation of powers and more clearly discussing disaster declarations. A memo from the governor is extended 3 times beyond Senate Bill 241, three times, and Megan Wallace has a memo, and we will also upload that, but I'm just going to basically high level that there is some legal issues with the disaster extensions, the 3 disaster declaration extensions, and hopefully at some point we'll have Department of Law before us. I did ask for Ed Sniffen, Attorney General, to come before. I was denied that today, and that's why we changed our focus today, but I'm hoping he will come. I know he's going to come for confirmation, so I'll ask him then if I have to. But anyway, right now, I would like to ask Commissioner Crum of Department of Health and Social Services to please come before the committee. He is asked to do a presentation. I wanted it to be open question and answers, and out of courtesy to the Department of Health and Social Services, I did submit some questions, and they were able to direct who they wanted online to answer some of the questions so they could be prepared for today's hearing. With that, Commissioner Crum, welcome to our committee. Oh, brief at ease. After a brief adjustment in the technology, I think they're ready to go. I have said I'm speaking too fast, so I want to tell everybody that we will have the health alerts all posted on BASIS and all the mandates, but I'm warning you, it's a lot of information that will be posted up there. But you guys, this was just high level for educational purposes, and you guys can go read the mandates in specific on your own, and then at a future date, obviously, we'll be dealing with several of these, including some of the health mandates, that health orders that are still in place based on these controversial continued disaster declarations. With that, your name's on almost every single thing in this book, and Commissioner Crum, and that's why it is, we are glad to have you before our committee, and you can move forth. You have the floor.
Good afternoon, Chair.
Is that on? There we go. Good afternoon, Chair Reinbold and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Adam Crum, and I serve as Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for the opportunity to present to the Senate Judiciary Committee today. I normally spend my time in front of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee and Senate Finance, so I'm happy to have some time in front of another important standing committee of the Senate, especially to talk about the state of Alaska response to COVID-19. This is a multifaceted discussion for all Alaskans, especially policymakers. And I look forward to presenting information to you, to answering questions. And as you mentioned earlier, I do have some staff online and other members from around the state who've been a part of the response.
Excuse me just for a second. Would you like me to mention who they are right now?
I was trying to save time.
Okay. So would you like me to do that?
Yeah, please.
Okay. So Dr. Joe McLaughlin, Department of Health and Social Services, Brian Fisher with Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Stacey Crowley with Department of Law, Paloma Harbor Policy and Analysis, are all online. Stand by. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, as odd as it sounds, we recently hit the year mark of when this kicked off in Alaska. On January 25th of 2020, I received a call. I was foolish enough to answer my phone at 8 a.m. on a Saturday from the Regional Administrator of Administration of Children and Families. And she asked, would we be willing to accept a flight from Wuhan, China for the repatriation of American citizens? And from there, it started off that we called to my Director of Public Health, Heidi Hedberg, Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, and we started working on, do we need to kick off our Health and Social Services Emergency Operating Committee? And so from there, we moved ahead. The State of Alaska did begin its response to COVID-19. Alaska's Health Emergency Response System has been activated since late January, officially on January 27th. And we've been working with federal, tribal, state, local healthcare partners to ensure we have strong systems in place to limit or prevent the spread of COVID-19. So things that occurred were we had time to learn from other states' experiences and preparedness, time to learn about the novel virus and science behind it, time to ensure that we had the initial infrastructure in place for response, time to ensure that we were engaging as many partners as possible for a comprehensive statewide response. This includes healthcare providers, tribal health organizations, local health entities, our vast network of public health centers and public health nurses, local governments, school districts, businesses, employers, critical infrastructure workforce and employers, and Alaskans, the most important component. Governor Dunleavy at the very beginning had three primary priorities: protect our seniors and Alaska's most vulnerable populations. We already knew that this group was being hit the hardest and the fastest from what was occurring in places like the state of Washington very early in January and February. Second thing was to protect and support rural Alaska. He made sure we were well aware of the 1918 pandemic of the Spanish flu and the historical example of what community spread can do in decimating populations of rural Alaska. And the third thing was the economic impact. He wanted to make sure that we could provide resources to assist those that will be economically impacted by the pandemic and remove those barriers as soon as possible. So in March of 2020, which is a weird thing to say because we're almost in March of 21, on March 11th, there were 100,000 cases of COVID-19 confirmed worldwide and 600 cases in the United States. So when we looked at this, knowing where we were at, Alaska's isolation, what it required, I did issue a public health memo to Governor Dunleavy requesting his consideration of issuing a public health emergency disaster declaration. And it said, because COVID-19 is a disease in humans, no one has an existing immunity to this virus. It appears likely that transmission can occur before the onset of symptoms. As such, some people who are infected could inadvertently transmit the virus to others. COVID-19 can cause severe disease, including pneumonia and death. Older individuals and people with serious underlying health conditions, such as lung disease, heart disease, or diabetes, or immune disorders, are at an increased risk for severe illness. There have been no confirmed cases of infection with the novel coronavirus in Alaska. For these reasons, under AS 2623-900-2E, I certify that an outbreak of COVID-19 has a high probability of occurring in the near future. And so when we looked at all that, about what occurred, there was a lot of items that came on. So on March 11th, the governor did issue his public health emergency disaster declaration. On March 12th, the first case of COVID-19 confirmed in Alaska. This was not an instance of community spread, however. We knew based on experiences from other states that we were watching closely, our time to respond to the virus was upon us. The legislature acted quickly, of which we are grateful, working with Governor Dunleavy's administration and collectively working on a bill that would extend the disaster declaration to November 15th, 2020. This is called SB 241. The bill contained many important provisions that would assist in the state's response for public health emergency for state agencies as well as for individual Alaskans. In March, I thank the legislature then for the deliver of action, and I thank you again. If it was not for your action, a lot of what we were able to accomplish in responses would not have been possible, and I fear that our outcomes would have been far more impactful. Increased number of cases, lack of testing capacity, lack of resources for labs and processing, and our ability to mobilize human and capital resources to support response efforts. While the Alaska legislature was positioning the state to be able to respond through the passage of SB 241, Congress was also passing important legislation. On March 11th, they did the Families First Act, which was unemployment insurance benefits, increased FMAP for Medicaid, testing, and insurance. On March 29th was the CARES Act. This was enhanced unemployment insurance, UI for gig workers and non-traditional contact workers, assistance for individuals, and allocations of federal aid to states. For Alaska, this was $1.25 billion to assist in establishing relief and response programs. So, Madam Chair, you had previously mentioned the initial health mandates. And so, under the governor's authority under AS 2623, he also issued these health mandates to assist in preventing and slowing community spread of COVID-19. And as you see from the issuance date on here, a lot of these all occurred within a very tight period. Mandates 1 through 12 all occurred in 2 weeks. Because the situation was upon us, information was coming fast and furious. I no longer worked at my office. Myself and Doctors, Inc. worked in the Atwood building with the governor. We pulled all-nighters throughout that entire time. His information was coming in. We were trying to figure out what is the best response. States around the rest of the country were doing various aspects. At that point in time, we were hearing the horror stories coming out of New York. As we looked at what was going on, we understood we had this really precarious state because we happened to be right in the middle of spring break. And so when we look at that across the state and people traveling and coming back to Alaska, as a lot of Alaskans leave in the spring, we had to actually make some decisions. And so there's a lot of factors involved in this. None of these were actually intended to be permanent measures, and we have removed most of them. This phase of the public health emergency was really important to the overall response, and the best thing was we wanted to make sure we preserved healthcare availability. Alaska has acute care beds in its hospitals for less than 2% of the population. And so we have to make sure that we measure those responses accurately and preserve that. And so we spent a lot of time throughout this as these items come up. As you look at the context of these items, when it says the travel one on Mandate 4 on March 17th, that actually was for international travel. These were individuals from the hotspot countries as identified by the CDC saying, if you come into Alaska, please quarantine. When we talk about elective medical procedures, we talked about, you know, can we push these off, the elective oral procedures. And then when it came to the Fairbanks actually was the first hotspot in the state of Alaska under Mandate 7. And we looked at where this was, and really we started understanding at that time this is spread by droplets and close physical contact. So separating those items and personal care services was one of those aspects that came out following some examples that occurred in other states. Then when we looked at number 8, which was the public and private schools, and we understanding, you know what, we have got to actually look at what is the best way. So delaying school and then ultimately moving to distance learning throughout the end of the year is one of the safest ways. Because the other thing we have to keep in mind at that time is we actually had a global shortage in PPE, or personal protective equipment. Hospital workers didn't have enough masks, didn't have enough gowns, didn't have enough face masks, let alone the general public. We also didn't know what was actually going to protect the general public as a whole. And so as these items were coming in, we had to make some decisions about what do we need to do. We need to buy time to put procedures, protocols in place. How do we do this? Where's the risks? Are we really in this? Also similar to that time, on March 25th, we had a report. There was multiple things. I believe Vice Chair Schauer actually alluded to projection of up to 20,000 deaths. Another one from the COVID Act now, in combination also with University of Alaska Anchorage, projected 11,000 deaths. And when you put that in the context of where we're at now, with 258 total deaths as of today, to me, yes, that is sad that people had to die that way, but we saved over 10,000 lives through these actions. And yes, those models may have been flawed, but those numbers actually came down, and we actually worked on that. And so when you also keep going down this list, you've got Mandate 10. This was the international and interstate combined. What this one was saying, you know what, if you come into the state of Alaska, we need you to quarantine. We don't have any place at time. We also actually don't understand how much testing capacity we have. This was when the labs were getting bogged down, 5-7 day turnaround. We didn't have enough swabs. Then we didn't have enough viral transport media. Then we didn't have enough transport tubes. And this all worked throughout the process because the entire system and industry across the board had to be built up around this. So much so that the governor actually reached out and encouraged manufacturing in the state of Alaska for swabs. And we found a partner in Triveris who actually manufactured them, and they're in Palmer with Senator Hughes. And so they started providing the swabs and responding to this. We were the first state in the country to do this. We had other states reach out, like, how did you get such local buy-in? When you look at number 11, which is the social distancing, this is the one that was actually exceptionally painful to do because we did call this the social distancing, and it actually did, as you said, closed non-essential or non-critical infrastructure businesses. Following this, we use the guidelines and template from the Cyber Infrastructure and Security Administration, which is a federal agency. They have listed throughout this their critical infrastructure document listing essential workers. Using that along with models from other states, we use that as a model, made sure we added Alaska-specific items such as mining, which was not specifically on the list, knowing how important that is to Northwest Alaska, as well as the interior and Southeast Alaska. About we need to make sure these resource development items are there. Then we moved into number 12, which was the intrastate travel. This was the limiting of travel between communities. This served twofold. This really just said, please don't travel anywhere else you don't need to. And again, look at the date on that. That is March 27th. March 25th was the date we got the projection from the university of 11,000 deaths. So as we looked at this, we're like, okay, please don't do this. But one of the things we did much different than any other state, we didn't say stay at home. We said, stay with your family and go outside. We actually waived the fees for the Alaska State Parks, and if anybody was out and about in the spring, you used to see, actually, we worried about clusters at trailheads because so many Alaskans were meeting up and doing their hikes and being outside and enjoying our beautiful state. We then moved into number 13, the public and private schools, and then number 14, which is the non-congregate sheltering order. This is actually a unique one. This is just simply specific language. We had to have an official document done in a rapid way in order to get FEMA reimbursement. So that is all number 14 is for. It actually identifies the population that we can provide FEMA reimbursement for. And then number 15, this is the services by healthcare providers. We had a lot of conversations on this with ASHNA, with the hospitalists, with different hospital associations, and different representatives of the medical profession about what it looks like if we put these safety protocols in place. How do we do this to really make sure people have access to care? Because that was a big concern, as Dr. Kuhldorf mentioned. We want to make sure people were not delaying care unnecessarily, and we put those items out there. And then we had number 16 on April 22nd. This was the Reopen Alaska Responsibly Plan. Well, we started moving forward with this, was saying, all right, here's the safe protocols for the businesses that were specifically shut down and had to sacrifice. How do we open you back up, give you safe tools to do so, the language to do so, so the general public also understands? And as we move forward through that, that was actually completely gone and rescinded by May 22nd. In 1 month, we completely removed Mandate 16, and there is no statewide restriction on businesses. And then on number 17, which is protective measures for independent commercial fishing vessels. This on April 23rd. This came out from a lot of hard work, working with all of our fishing communities around the state, because we've got different crews, we've got commercial harvesters, we've got independent fishing harvesters, we have onshore and offshore seafood processors, and they're all in rural, remote areas of the state that need support, and these were individuals we were talking with since the month of March in order to figure out, how do we protect your community, how do we give them, you know what, to come here and be safe, harvest this resource, which we all need, how do you do that safely? And these were guidelines which were mutually worked out and agreed to with the industry partners themselves. It was a blanket thing. And then number 18, which was the interstate travel. This one, actually, we said, okay, travel around the state, but we also had to make sure that there were small communities that were completely shutting off travel, meaning that state workers, even police officers, corrections officers, individuals released from prisons, they were not allowing back in their home communities. They weren't allowing residents to leave to go get critical essential items. And so we wanted to make sure that property owners in the state, if you own property here, you had access to get back into those communities. And that was why we wrote specific language around this one, which really is protecting people's access to their property and making sure that essential emergency-based items or critical items could still occur. So then when you, and also you had mentioned, I apologize, you had mentioned it was the health alerts. So the health alerts actually are nothing to do with the governor. Those come from Department of Health and Social Services. These are just simply guidance. These are guidelines. You know what? Here's some recommendations for you to do this. And one item you mentioned actually brings a smile to my face because it was actually a fantastic item. When we talked about the how far cars can park, we had weekly calls with religious and faith leaders from around the state, and the governor was leading this. And they asked us, how do we actually get together and have a massive Easter celebration safely? Is there a way to do that? And so we thought and we pondered on what are some ways that we could do this, which is how we came up with those guidelines, which was, you know what, you can do in your cars. Here's some other items you can do this, because they said, no, a lot of us will get together and volunteer and build baskets and bring those to Homebound. And so we put that together. I'm proud to say I was able to participate in a massive event in Palmer where I think it was 2,000 or 3,000 people showed up at an Easter celebration. And so that was actually kind of a neat thing of coming together throughout this. So when you look at a lot of these mandates, the vast majority of them were actually repealed by summertime. By June, we actually had moved on the travel side into mandatory testing for non-residents into the state of Alaska, so we can actually salvage a little bit of the tourist season, allow our hospitality industry to thrive, of which they are very appreciative, and we worked very hard with them to make sure this was in place. And so we implemented this at 10 airports around the state. And so a lot of these items were there. Current ones that are still in place have been moved into health orders. So when we go to the state response components, I'd like to talk about some of the essential core components of the state's response. So these are items that are tied to the disaster declaration and then SB 241 and then further disaster declarations. Waiver and suspension of statutes and regulations. Examples are allowed for expanded telehealth opportunities, including behavioral health. A lot of the items that CMS, or Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, put in as flexibilities for healthcare providers, the state could not access because of current existing regulations. We had to waive or suspend said regulations in order to get those federal flexibilities. We also resulted in our ability to build our healthcare workforce without hurdles to licensing for qualified licensed individuals from other states. We did this through some rapid emergency licensing and some reciprocity agreements. There's also contracts and procurement in HR. One thing that everybody knows who's either in the legislature as well as working in state government, contracts take a long time, right? We go through the standard RFP process, and there's a reason for that. But in the middle of a response, you need to flatten out government and be able to hire and procure quickly and immediately in order to do responses. So examples are purchase of PPE, testing supplies, hiring temp employees for contact tracing and data entry, right? Because Alaskans wanted to see what are we tracking. We kept getting requests, how do we do this? And so we actually had to bring on people to help us build the website in the dashboard that you see now. We also had to bring in, it was a kind of a neat event, was PPE was not available globally. And so we actually worked with a buyer in China and got it was a Linden jet, it was a McDonnell Douglas something or other, flew full of equipment. You know what I'm talking about? It flew from China to the Alaska and given us a stockpile of gloves and masks and gowns. And it gave us a surplus that we could stock up and meet the requests for the first time in months of all of the hospitals around the state who couldn't procure these through normal supply chains. These are some of the items we were able to do because of the flexibilities in the disaster declaration. We also had to enter into contracts for the distribution of supplies to make sure that items were actually moved around the state and secure alternative care sites so communities are ready to respond. And while I am just so thankful we haven't had to use those as essentially field hospitals, we have been able to use those as mass testing sites, as monoclonal antibody infusion therapy treatments in Anchorage, as well as mass vaccination clinics. And those mass vaccination clinics, which in Anchorage did almost 3,000 seniors in just a weekend, would not have been possible without the flexibility of the disaster declaration that we used, because we had to procure and hire quickly healthcare professionals and a contract in order to administer that. As far as the testing side, we had established community testing sites, work in partnership with local healthcare providers, tribal health organizations. We had to beef up our lab, data integration into existing and CDC portals. Contact tracing, right? This was a big deal for months in our conversation at our weekly press conference. Allowed for partnership with the University of Alaska, tribal health organizations, local governments to build workforce to conduct contact tracing. Improving IT systems and networks to provide an efficient system of data delivery and support a truly statewide workforce. I would like to say on the contact tracing side, we did mention our goal was to get 500 through our partnership working with tribal health entities, the state of Alaska, and contract employees. We're actually up to 489 contact tracers. So we also had to work with critical industries. They came to us and said, how do we protect our workforce? We need to maintain our transient workforce, because even residents in Alaska going to the oil patch have to rotate on and off. They asked for help and plan, and so we worked with them on that. Then we had partnerships and collaborations across the board, different state agencies, school districts, local health departments, making sure that we were having them engaged. Local emergency operations centers, what were their specific items? Are we doing proper outreach for the specific items that they're trying to deal with at that point in time, and what's upcoming? So there was all kinds of outreach throughout this that allowed us to do this. Communications was a very strong emphasis to make sure Alaskans knew what was occurring. We had weekly press conferences. We talked about mitigation measures, symptoms, how to get tested, when to get tested, how to quarantine, what's a small bubble, and then it came into many forms. There was traditional radio, TV, print, social media. We had local influencers and so on. When we saw a specific demographic pop up, we actually went and got local influencers in that group to say, hey, can you talk to your community about what's one of the ways to keep safe? And we saw numbers in specific communities, particularly in Anchorage, start going down. And so all this is a lot of different stuff. We also have Echoes. An Echo is really a mass Zoom. It's a Zoom license that allows you to actually have thousands of people join onto it. We do this 5 days a week on different topics, all open to the public, all recorded. Science Echoes, provider Echoes, educator Echoes, local government, media, vaccines, you name it, there was an Echo for it. We also have subject matter experts available all the time to answer questions. It's all archived. They can be viewed. I just want to say thank you to our partners at the University of Alaska Anchorage for facilitating this particular platform. It's been immensely popular and helpful. So as we go through talking about the vaccine in Alaska, we had a lot that came up. We received a lot of feedback from the public as well as members of the legislature on how we can improve our systems in order to assist Alaskans in finding availability of appointments and scheduling appointments. So a lot has occurred. So throughout this, in May, we knew that a vaccine was working through Operation Warp Speed, which was announced in April. So we started talking about our immunization program. Then in August, the governor officially had us kick off Alaska Vaccine COVID-19 Vaccine Task Force. And then we had the task force that was co-led by Health and Social Services and the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. We're co-leads and partners in this. On October 16th, we submitted a draft vaccination plan to the CDC. The state vaccination plan outlined the organizational approach to distribution, provider enrollment, tracking, and public communication. It also includes draft plans for allocation and all of those items. We also had the Vaccine Advisory Committee, which is made up of healthcare professionals, nurses, doctors, hospital administrators, and scientists and bioethicists. Then as we move into, throughout that time frame, then that gets us to November 15th, and then the SB 241 expired. At that point in time, we're looking at what we needed to do to continue this response. We knew that we had a pending vaccine that was going to be approved by the federal government, and we're looking and waiting at that. We're also looking at that point in time, we had a surge in cases. November was a rough month for Alaska when it came to death counts, as well as the cases rising up. And so Governor Dunleavy issued a disaster declaration because I sent another public health memo to the governor saying, unfortunately, the COVID-19 emergency has not abated, and we are no longer anticipating an imminent threat, but instead infections are occurring in Alaska and have recently increased exponentially. Thus, a new disaster declaration is necessary as an outbreak of disease is occurring under AS 26-23-902E. Despite the state's aggressive measures to contain and mitigate, we continue to face escalating challenges. As of November 16th, 48 million cases confirmed worldwide, 9 million cases in the U.S., and 17,000 confirmed cases and 84 deaths in Alaska. So we've revised what were the health mandates into 8 health orders, but a number of those were actually not mandates to begin with. There is a health order that actually talks about online gaming that allows nonprofits who typically use raffles and things like that, they can do those items online. And there's other aspects in there when it comes to actually not increasing fees. So state agencies cannot increase fees for the general public throughout the duration of this declaration. And these are some of the items. When it says 8 health orders, there's really the ones that apply that are carryovers are number 4, which is just the FEMA order, allowing us to actually build against, reimburse against FEMA. Number 5, for interstate travel. And this came about in conversation. At that time also, we had a very bad outbreak in the Bethel or the YK region. And so there was a lot of questions around local communities saying, give us the tools in order to help us protect ourselves. And so we worked with them to say, okay, please get a test before you go into these regions. And that's what this one says. Number 6, which is international interstate travel, which is a carryover. It's just our airport testing plan, which has been lauded. And we actually had documents published by the CDC about our proactive approach to that for travel. And number 8, which is the commercial fishing industry protective measures. They were combined into a single document to make it a little bit easier for the public to see. So 4, 5, 6, and 8. And then what that led into was a quick 30 days into December 15th. And again, the time came and we looked at this and the governor's current disaster declaration was starting to expire. And so during another assessment, we looked at, did another memo saying we need another disaster declaration in order to do this. Important items that occurred was that on December 11th, 2020 was the emergency use authorization for the Pfizer vaccine. December 18th was the emergency use authorization for the Moderna vaccine. And again, as I said, the point of dispensing clinics, which we have used successfully around the state to serve and protect our seniors, would not have been possible without our quick ability to procure both resources and staff. And you also see, when we look at the orders in place, it's the exact same orders that were in place in the prior disaster declaration. Nothing new is added. And then that brings us into the January 15th disaster declaration. As we look at this, we're going through this list about, you know, how do we actually protect these individuals? We have these vaccines in hand, but at that point in time, we had not yet actually administered very many. And so there's a particular line, AS 26-23-020-G10, which allows the governor in a disaster declaration to allocate or redistribute food, water, fuel, clothing, medicine, or supplies. This includes therapeutics such as monoclonal antibodies, things that we were administering at the Alaska Airlines Center in Anchorage and around the state, and the guidance from the state is to administer those to age 65 and older who were COVID positive. And the tremendous response has been it has absolutely helped keep them out of the hospital. It also allows us to do eligibility criteria and tiers for the vaccines. I agreed with so much that Dr. Kuhldorf said about protecting our seniors and our elders, and most of what we have done has been that. It is daily, multi-day testing, visitor testing at all of our congregate settings for our seniors. It is getting all of our skilled nursing facilities and pioneer homes vaccinated along with staff members. And so we have really tried to do this. Again, it goes back to governor's number one priority of protecting seniors and the vulnerable population. And we're working now to make sure we get distributions out carried to homebound, you know, the developmentally disabled and families and caregivers to make sure they're a part of this and they're being taken care of. And I'm proud to say that our efforts have paid off. We are the number one per capita state at 11.3%, almost two full percentage points better than West Virginia in the amount of the vaccines per capita, which is something that we should all be tremendously proud of because this was a statewide lift across the board. We're averaging right now 4,600 shots a day. And this is completely voluntary. This is an individual's right. If they want to protect themselves, to take this. No staff are mandated on this. No individuals are mandated this from the state level. When we look at our COVID cases, the second most tested state per capita, second fewest deaths per state, and we are the number one lowest case fatality rate. And so when we've been able to do this, we've had capacity in our hospitals, and the hospitals have maintained financial health. They're not 100% what they were, but we worked with them throughout this response to make sure they got tools that they needed and they were properly supported throughout this. So this is a lot of tools that we have been able to use throughout. Just yesterday, the state of Alaska received the vaccine allocation numbers for the month of February. So this is, we're getting 21,000 of Moderna, 19,500 of Pfizer, 10,704 of Moderna for IHS, and 7,800 for Pfizer for IHS. This is 59,600 total coming to the state, and about 41,000, which is for the state alone to distribute and allocate out. So in January, we also hit some other milestones.
Okay, you know what? We've only got 3 minutes, well, actually 2 minutes left before the committee ends. So I have to interrupt you because I've got to do closing comments. But first of all, where are the adverse reactions posted on the Department of Health and Social Services website?
We tell people to go. There's the Vaccine Adverse Experience Response site, which is a site that's monitored by the CDC. And so healthcare providers, if there's an adverse reaction, are encouraged to put anything. Even if somebody were to stand up too quickly and get lightheaded, they say, as a provider, enter that into the VAERS system.
How can the people see that?
We put that on our site, and we tell people this is where this is housed. This is information that goes to the CDC.
So the public is freely open to look at all of those. Yeah, if you could send me the link to that, that would be great. I know I'm monitoring it in a few different areas, like on Facebook, COVID reactions are on there. And I really wanted a lot of question and answers, but there's no time. I don't run my committee meetings over. I do the best never to do that. Do you take an oath to the Constitution, and do you understand that it is the supreme law of the land?
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. I'm an American.
Okay, because I just want the people to know that I'd ask for no presentation today. I gave you tremendous leeway because you guys have had front and center for 10 months. You've had your, the media. You've had everybody eating out of your hands, basically, for the last 10 months. This was an opportunity for question and answers for my committee. So I did give you tremendous leeway. Next time it will not be this way. It will be because out of honor of you, I submitted questions at a time. You didn't answer a single one of my questions. So a little bit disappointing. But I will tell you that we will have future meetings. And to me, it's nice to have a sales, to what the governor has done. But there's another side to the story. And I really wanted to get to the people online, which we didn't have the opportunity to do. But, for example, the impacts to the students. There's a lot of articles that 1 in 4 kids are struggling out there. That's not being addressed. You're too excited about what you're doing. The focus on COVID, there's a bigger picture to life. There's a tremendous amount of businesses that have gone under. Our economy is in shambles in many, many areas right now. Freedoms have been restricted. Our elderly have not gotten some of the love and attention that they've needed during this time. And I've talked to several people that said they would have rather had COVID than being locked up and in isolation away from their loved ones. There's been an other side, and that's what we wanted to address because you guys have gotten your time to market this for the last 10 months, but a lot of the public has not been heard. So in the future, I do want to talk about the flaws to the models that you use. You claim you saved X number of lives. We're going to look at those models since you brought them up. There are some massive flaws in some original models that were used, and to claim that you save lives based on flawed models, I think, causes me tremendous pause.
Madam Chair, I did mention that they ended up being flawed.
Yeah. Well, you still claimed. So, I think that was a very much of a red flag for me in regards to the contract tracing. You bragged about 1,000 people. You now are contract tracing people on. Right, roughly
489.
489. Okay,
half of 1,000.
I didn't write the number down there. But to me, that's something I want to have a conversation about. What you're doing, how you're interacting with these people, because the legislature is supposed to implement privacy in Article 1, Section 22. And if the executive branch isn't doing that, we got to reel you in somehow to make sure that that there's a balance between constitutional rights there. Of course, public safety somewhere is on, the constitutional rights to the public safety. It can't be, the swing can't be, you give everything up over here. It's really, really important to never forget what our founding fathers did, what the oppression that they dealt with, and what the pilgrims and the founding fathers and the oppressions that they dealt with, and what they did to fight and die for the freedoms that we have now. And a lot of the freedoms have been very, very much under attack over the last 10 months. and it's a very serious issue. And so there is going to be, the public will have an opportunity to talk about the impacts to the unemployment, how many people are unemployed, how many businesses have gone under, the people who have not gotten their screenings, the suffering of the elderly, the suffering of the children. There's another side to the impacts of what you guys have done. And we will be talking about some of this in the future and the rights of people, you know, to be fully informed about the vaccinations, whether safety trials were skipped or not. And we will be having some of that because people need to know if they have the right to say no to these vaccinations.
Madam Chair, if I may, 100%. Governor Dunleavy and myself have been very adamant. State of Alaska does not mandate or require vaccines for employees, staff, or seniors.
Right.
So if people have that ability, it is a personal choice.
Okay, and thank you for getting that on the record, but we're going to be digging into that at a future date. We don't have time. We're 2 minutes over, which I don't like to run my committee meetings over, but those are discussions. People need to know, you know, the rights of the children, the rights of the elderly, the rights of employment, and things like that in regards to, you know, the mask were all voluntary or whatever, and then they ended up being mandated. So people are very concerned for a rightful reason. And these vaccinations, if you look at the trials, some of the earlier trials with mRNA vaccinations in the animal trials, they're extraordinarily alarming. And we've got to look at the long-term effects of these vaccinations as well. And some of that data is not out. And so I want to also ask you, are the people who create these vaccinations, are they liable for all the adverse reactions?
Ma'am, that's a question for the CDC and the congressional delegation.
And what is your answer?
I am not the CDC or the congressional delegation, Madam Chair.
So you're proud of pushing, how many vaccinations did you say a day?
4,600.
4,600.
When it comes to the liability side, that is absolutely a federal issue under the PREP Act.
Okay, so I'm just saying that it's also part of public health, and or, you know, it's a very, very serious concern long term. If we're talking about public health, those are the kind of questions that need to be answered in the end. But with that, we've got to close. We are late. Save your questions. We're going to have multiple meetings in regards to this. But I only have this room till 3 o'clock, so we're going to have a lot more options to talk. This is a very serious issue for Alaskans, and I want to thank you for coming before our committee. And thank you guys. I know you guys have been. You guys have several unanswered emails, but I know you're working on those. So with that, we are going to temporarily still have our meeting on Friday. You guys, this is going to be continued on Friday if I get the proper confirmations from the administration, the speakers. If not, I may have to cancel this meeting. But as of right now, it will be held in this meeting again. Continue this discussion from 1:30 to 3 o'clock on Friday. With that, we're going to have to gavel out at 3:04. Thank you.